those four areas that we have coloured in there or circled in there, that is Daniel 11, essentially. Not the latter part of it, which is our time, but those four areas are the core of Daniel 11. It has to do with a territory in Egypt called the King of the South, the territory up here in Syria way, King of the North. The Maccabees come into it for a bit, and we will have a look at them. And then the growth of this little horn power up in the corner. Essentially, that's Daniel 11, except the last five or six verses, which jump right through to the time of the end. And I think Daniel does that very deliberately, because what God is saying is that this core section of the eastern leg of the Roman Empire, which Daniel was portraying in Daniel chapter 11, is going to play its part in the latter days at the time of the end. And so he jumps straight across to there, leaves out all the European history. That's in Revelation. That's the western leg of the Roman Empire. And that's all there in Revelation. But in this section here, he's concentrating in the eastern section around the land of Israel. Now, in the latter end of chapter 10, you have these words which sort of form the introduction to chapter 11. It says there in verse 21, I will show thee that which is noted in the scripture of truth. And he is linking here the issues to do with all of the things which have come about before, and he's going to show him what God is going to do into the future years. Now, there's a summary of Daniel 11. We're going to work through most of that this evening, except maybe the latter part might get carried over to next time. It has to do for about a 500-year period of history before Christ. So it's after they've returned from captivity under the Persians, and Daniel 11 covers that stretch from that time right up to the Lord Jesus Christ. The first verse, he just sets the time scene with Gabriel. We know it's Gabriel because he was the one back in chapters 9 and 10 that appeared to Daniel. In fact, chapters 9 through to 12 are all in that first year at the end of Daniel's life, but the first year of the King Darius and Cyrus the Mede. And so there are in verse 2, four kings of Persia. It moves on in verses 3 to 4 to Alexander the Great. And then it comes to this section, verses 5 through to verse 31, which we didn't particularly read, just one of those verses. But that has to do with the King of the North versus the King of the South. And I didn't get the brother to read those verses because they really are a little tedium to go through the battles that were going on between those two territories. And that's the core of those verses. And we're going to look at those in a summary way when we get to that point. And then we will look at the Maccabees. We will look at the growth of the little horn, because that's very, very important to link to the rest of Daniel's prophecy. So that's a breakup of the chapter itself. Verse 1 says, it's the first year of Darius the Mede, and I stood to confirm and to strengthen Daniel. That's Gabriel talking. He was there confirming and strengthening Daniel in this point. As we say, chapter 9, verse 2, it's the same time period. It's the time period of the 70 weeks prophecy, which Brother Justin took us through when we considered that chapter, the 490 years. So Gabriel's now going to say to Daniel, this is what's going to happen across those 490 years, not only in a general way, but a very specific way with those parties we had on the first screen. Now, verse 2 says, behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. Now, there are the four kings. There's Cambyses, the usurper Smerdis, who only lasted about 8 months, Darius Hystaspes, and Xerxes up to 465. And it's exactly as Daniel says here, or Gabriel says to Daniel, that's exactly as history recorded it. There were four kings of Persia, and the last one was the most famous, as we'll see in a moment. It says here, he was far richer than they all. By his strength, he will stir up all the realm against the Greeks who will come next. You know, this detail here is so precise that many critics of the Bible have said this must have been written after the event, sometime towards the time of Christ or whatever, when these things had all happened. Because the detail here is so precise. It doesn't miss a step. It doesn't sort of get five kings of Persia instead of the four. It even includes that usurper. All that detail is there in precision. God is saying to Daniel, and particularly to us at the time of the end, I have made this prophecy, and history, as people often say, is poured into that mould. This is what's going to happen, and the angels of God are working to make sure that detail comes about exactly as God has laid down. Now, that fourth king, Xerxes, as we read in verse 2, he amassed great riches. He got an army of some 5+ million. He cut a canal through the isthmus of Mount Athos. It was about 2 kilometres long, 30 metres wide, and about 3 metres deep, just enough to get his dry marine thing through. That's a picture of that area today. It's not a big area, that isthmus, but by cutting through that canal, he was able to fool the Greeks, shorten his journey, and was able to overcome the Grecian forces. That little slide up in the corner is prior to that's today's story. It's all silted over, but you can go there today and see the extent of that canal that Xerxes carved there. Exactly as God said here, he would, through his strength and his riches, stir up against the realm of Greece. So he then mounted that naval and military campaign with his 200 ships using that isthmus, and he returned to Persia, but he left a very great legacy of hatred with the Greek people, which was visited upon the Persian Empire by Alexander and the Greeks next. But that detail in verse 2 is exactly as God outlined it. Verse 3, a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. Alexander the Great. Just quickly look at Daniel 8 and verse 5 and verse 21. It says at the end of verse 5 of Daniel 8 that the goat, the Grecian goat, had a notable horn between his eyes. That's your Alexander the Great. Over in verse 21, the rough goat is the king of Grecia. The great horn is that is between his eyes is the first king. That's Alexander the Great. He's known as that in history because, as it says in verse 3, he shall rule with great dominion. And he did. In a matter of 20 or so years, he swept right through the whole of the Persian Empire and overcame their opposition and established the brazen-coated Greeks as the rulers of the Middle Eastern Empire. He defeated the Persians at 2 battles, conquered Egypt, founded Alexandria, including a library there, which became very, very famous, eventually housed the Septuagint, not in his time, but years and years later. But he established all of those things, Alexandria in his name, obviously. Sacked Babylon, Susa, Persepolis, and he got as far as the Indus River, right across to the right-hand side there of the map, and he ran out of territory. That was the extent of the Persian Empire. He had conquered the whole lot in a very, very short space of time, and then returned to Babylon. And having returned to Babylon, he died. 12 years. In that time, verse 3 of chapter 11 was accomplished, and it was a great dominion. The Bible uses just a few expressions at times, but they always capture the point of the history that is there. And here's another example there with Alexander. He shall rule with great dominion. In 12 years, he took the whole of that Persian Empire on, conquered the lot, and then died. His work was done. It there says in verse 4, when he shall stand up, when Alexander shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken. 12 years is a very small space of time. He stood up for 12 years, he did what he did, and then his kingdom was broken. And notice it says here, it was going to the four winds of heaven, not to his posterity. He had no family. So there was no dynasty set up here by Alexander. So the record says quite clearly, not to his posterity. Once again, the precision of the angels writing this record, nor according to his dominion. So the next set of rulers weren't going to have that entire area that we saw back here. They weren't going to have all of that as their one kingdom, because it says here, not according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others beside those. So no one inherited all of that. It was broken up between his four generals, as we see there in verse 4 and as we have it on the screen. Once again, we won't turn to it, but Daniel 8 verse 8 says the same things. These are the four horns that came up from the broken horn of the horn of the goat. And there's the four leaders who took and carved up the empire of Alexander. And here's what it looked like when that all settled down. There was a little bit of shuffling around, but this is where it finished up in a matter of a few years after Alexander had died. You have the what is known in history as the Ptolemaic Empire, the Ptolemies, the Seleucid Empire, and you have up here the other two of those generals who had sections up in that northern area of Turkey, northwest of Turkey there and into Greece. But it didn't last long like that. It wasn't long before that territory was shrunk a little bit more. In verses 5 to 9, we come to that section there. And if we read verse 5, the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him and have dominion, and his dominion shall be a great dominion. And that's exactly what happened in that southern section. The southern section was that Ptolemaic Empire down the bottom of the screen, and there was quite a bit of struggling amongst a couple of the generals for that territory. First of all, it went to the Madon, but it was wrested from him by Ptolemy the First, Ptolemy Soter. And we're going to see these names coming up time and again through these verses. Ptolemy the First, Ptolemy the Second, Third, Fourth, sometimes Soter, sometimes something else. It can get very, very, very muddly when you're trying to work through that. But Ptolemy the First consolidated it in the south, and for the next 52 years, which is what verse 5 is about, they had to and fro between those two territories, between the Seleucid and the Ptolemaic. There was this continual battling between the territories which they had. Now, at this point, I just want to show on the screen here, you can't read that, you might if you've got really good eyes, but that's a chart that you can get through Manny from the library. It's an excellent chart if you don't have it. It shows you all of the kings of the south and the kings of the north. It gives you a brief history in that bottom section there. That gives you a history of that whole time. And it traces up the top here, the king of the north and the king of the south and their various names. It can be very, very, very muddly when you work through that. But this chart helps you to work that out. We're not going to go through all that tonight. You just notice here, dear Cleopatra on there, if you can read that there. We're not going to touch that either, but when you're reading through that, this is not the Cleopatra and the Mark Antony of history. There were about six Cleopatras, and this is one of the first that occurs here in Daniel 11, but her and Antony are two, a bit later in history, something like about 40 years before Christ, and the record doesn't go right through to that level of detail. Now, I'm going to give you merely a summary. You can get a copy of that slide, no problem at all. And that takes you through from verse 6 to verse 18, and the battles between the king of the south and the king of the north. And the precision here is, as I said before, absolutely wonderful. Same thing again from verses 19 through to verse 31. It is tedious up here to try and work through all that detail. And I'm going to suggest that it's far more useful to you to get hold of the prophecy of Daniel, if you have it. If not, it's in the library. Go to page 48 of Brother Thomas's work, and he has there a few pages paraphrasing those verses we put up on the screen. Very easy to read, not complicated, and you can just open Daniel 11, go through the verse and see exactly what it means in terms of the king of the north and the king of the south. Much, much better for you to do that than for me to stand here and work through that tedium. Now, as I said, get hold of that chart, get hold of Brother Thomas's book. With that chart and his paraphrase, you can open up those verses quite easily just by reading through them and noting down the details. So we're going to jump to a couple of examples. I'll take you to verse 14 just to show you what's there, but not to go through every one of those verses. Take verse 14. This here is King of the South, and we'll take an example of King of the North. It's around about 200 before Christ. It's dealing with another Ptolemy in the south, this time a fifth one called Epiphanes. He was only a child. Now we read in verse 14, child when he came to the throne. In those times there shall stand up many against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish division, but they shall fall. So at this point, 205, there was quite a grouping of power against the king of the south. Why? He's only 5 years old. We can knock this guy off. And so that's what really they attempted to do in terms of coming against the king of the south. Philopater was succeeded by his infant son. He was only 5 years old. The northern section, the Macedonian, Syrian kings, and Scopas, his father's general, all plotted against him. They thought this was easy prey. We can, as it says there in verse 14, they can stand up against the king of the south. But the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves. That word robbers, as Rotherham and Young's literature say, the oppressors, the destroyers, it's the Roman little horn. It's the first time that the Romans are coming into the record. It's 200 years or so before Christ. They were not a power, but they were a growing power. And they became guardians to that young king in the south. But it says at the end of verse 14, they shall fall. The Romans weren't strong enough to overcome all the opposition. They stopped them from toppling this young five-year-old, but they could do no more than that. They shall fall. Their power was yet to come, as we'll see in the future of this chapter. Verse 28, let's take an example of a king of the north, this time Antiochus, the fourth Epiphanes. You're going to find as you go through there that you'll say, I thought Epiphanes was the king of the north, and he is. But you see his name crop up in the king of the south too. They borrowed names, they borrowed wives, they intermarried across the borders to try and strengthen their territories. If that didn't work, some of them poisoned each other, particularly the the ladies were very adept at poisoning the opposition. So you find all of that detail in there at one time or another. So this is Antiochus in 169 in verse 28. Not Antiochus the Great, he was actually before this gentleman here, but he still took the name of Antiochus. Antiochus, you know, Antioch in the New Testament, that comes from the name of these kings in the north and in the area of Syria. So verse 28. Then shall he return to his land with great riches. His heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. Now he was one of the more nastiest ones of the kings of the north. First of all, he shall return to his own land with great riches. He was in the process around 169 of invading Egypt, and he heard a false report about himself, and he was enraged by it, blaming the Jews in Jerusalem. He came to that place, and as it says here, he slew 80,000 or so Jews. He plundered the temple. He sold many into slavery. He deliberately entered the most holy place, which even Jews, of course, couldn't do, and he just didn't bother about that at all. Desecrated that. He took a female pig and burnt it on the altar of burnt offering, absolutely enraging the Jewish people. And then he returned to Antioch with all his spoils of war and said, in effect, don't say false things about me anymore. So that's what we read in verse 28. He'll return to his land with great riches, but his heart will be against the people of the Holy Covenant. And he'll do exploits and return to his own land. And he certainly did that. Then we come to verse 32 through to verse 35, and we'll spend a little more time in these latter verses. The Maccabees, they come into the record here at verse 32. Such as do wickedly against the covenant shall be corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and shall do exploits. And that's exactly what happened in this time period around 167 or so BC. The Jews became absolutely fed up with this north-south business and the treatment they received at the hands of Antiochus, Epiphanes particularly, and assisted, as we say here, by apostate Jews who likewise weren't happy with what had happened. They actually went against Antiochus because of the things which he had done. But you see here in verse 32, such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt with flatteries. So he associated Antiochus with these apostate Jews to disrupt Jewish observances, forbid circumcision, burnt copies of the law, and first force people to offer and eat swine flesh, which they were not allowed to do under the law. But it says in contrast, the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And that's the introduction of the Maccabee clan into this record. There was the father, Mattathias. He had five sons, and this was the family tree. And get that all of these things pretty well off the net these days. So you have Mattathias there. He was the father figure, and he revolted in 167. After all of this stuff by Antiochus for the king of the north that did against the people, he said enough's enough, and he gathered the people together and revolted against them. He had five sons. That's that next line along there, starting with John, finishing with Jonathan over there. Three of them were particularly the leaders of the Maccabean revolt over the next 20 or so years. Mattathias, in fact, died within a couple of years or so there of his revolt, but Judas took over. Judas Maccabeus was the first one to actually really conquer the king of the north and the territory of that time, followed by Simon, and then Jonathan here. Those three boys of Mattathias carried on the tradition of the Maccabees. I've just circled down there out of interest. Herod the Great, down the bottom of that chart. As it says there, about 36 before Christ onwards. The Herods of Jesus' time were married into that Maccabean culture and Maccabean chain of people. The Maccabeans became very, very famous, of course, at that time. And they whipped up the Jews and were able to have complete independence for some 100 or more years, up until when the Romans came along and subjugated them a few decades before Christ. But up to that time, they had complete independence. And they became an icon to the Jewish people. Not only then, but even today, the Maccabees are spoken of with quite some acclaim by the Jewish people for their exploits of that time. The Pharisees came from this group. They were upholders of the law in the early days, but across 100 or more years that became somewhat lax, and they got closed in with all of the jots and tittles, and they lost the intent and the spirit of the law, as we know from the teachings of our Lord in the New Testament. But in the first instance, those Pharisees revived the spirit of the law in those times. Verse 33, they shall fall, but there shall be hope and with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. So they understood many things and instructed many people. And as I said, the Pharisees came out of that group in time. But they suffered many reverses, but maintained their adherence to the law. In verse 34, they says here at the end, many shall cleave to them with flatteries. And that's exactly what happened. Although they had great victories, defeating Lysias with 47,000 men against their 3,000, nevertheless, unfaithful Jews joined with them in a political sense rather than for the true religious sense that they were trying to create here. In verse 35, some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge them and to make them white even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. I find that a extremely encouraging verse. In the middle of all of this detail of the exploits of these kings and even of the Maccabees, God says there is, as there is in all ages, always a few that maintain the faith. And that's what it's saying here in verse 35. Some of them of understanding shall fall, but it will try them and purge them and make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time of appointed. Them of understanding, same word wise in Daniel 12 and skill in chapter 1 and verse 17. So these are people in the midst of these very tumultuous times who held fast to their God, and they looked to the time appointed, the time of the end. Now that's the first time that this expression, the time of the end, comes into the record here. And it's going to come into the record a lot more, as we shall see. It's over in verse 40, which we'll get to this evening. It's in chapter 12 and verse 1. It's in chapter 12 and verse 4. Chapter 12 and verse 9. Daniel, Gabriel is introducing to us here the time of the end. That even in the days of the Maccabees, there were those who looked forward to the end of those times appointed. They didn't know it. I mean, it was 2,500 years away for them. They didn't know that. But God said there will be an end to all of this strife and suffering. It is for a time appointed. And that expression is there in Psalm 102. There will come a time when God shall arise and have mercy upon Zion. The time to favour her, the set time is come. And we are on the cusp of those words becoming about to pass in the Middle East. Verse 36. The theme changes now. It's in the time of the Maccabees, but God says, I'm just going to now bring into play another power in this whole scene. It says in verse 36, the king shall do according to his will. He shall exalt himself, magnify himself above every god, and so forth. Now, you just notice the change there. May be a little subtle perhaps, but it doesn't say, and the king of the south, or the king of the north. It says, the king shall do according to his will. And that is a very deliberate change in the wording from the verses that have occurred many times in the past in this chapter here. It is not the king of the south. It is not the king of the north. God is saying there is going to arise another power structure here, which is going to have an effect upon this whole scene in the eastern leg of the Roman Empire. Now, we said here, Rome established itself in around the second century, about halfway through, up in this little territory here, including Byzantium or Constantinople, as Istanbul as it is now. Rome inherited a section up there, and it gave them a geographical foothold into that area, which probably didn't mean much to the peoples of those times, but it gave them that foothold. And as it says in verse 36, this king shall do according to his will, and that's where his basis was established, in the east, in that little area around Pergamum, which you can see today, as well as Byzantine or Constantinople. Says in those verses, he shall do according to his will. He shall be a king of fierce countenance. It says there in verse 36 that he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god and speak marvelous things against the God of gods. And he will prosper until the indignation be accomplished, for that which is determined shall be done. So God says, a statement that could easily be contradicted over hundreds of years. He says, look, this little horn power that's rising up there around Constantinople and Pergamum, 150 odd years before Christ, it's going to continue and prosper till the indignation be accomplished. It's going to prosper for 2,000 odd years. And it has. The Roman power in the east and in the west has gone from that time forward and prospered. It's had its reverses up and down, but we know the power even today of that Roman Catholic system. And it began there in a little way in that territory in the second century BC. Look, I think you need to just establish those points. Daniel 8 verses 9 to 10. So these are connected into chapter 11. This king of fierce countenance, Daniel chapter 8 and verses 9 and 10, perhaps going back even to chapter 8, verse 8 rather of chapter 8. The he-goat, the Grecian he-goat, Alexander, waxed strong and the great horn was broken. Alexander was snapped off in his prime and the four notable ones came out, those four generals. And out of one of them, gave another little horn, which in terms of Daniel 11, waxed exceeding great towards southeast and went towards the land of Israel across time. But it came out of one of those territories, like we saw before, just flipping back here, came from that territory, which was one of the four territories that was controlled by the generals of Alexander. And so Those connections are all there in those scriptures there. This is the little horn of Daniel chapter 8, the king of fierce countenance of Revelation 12, is also mentioned in Deuteronomy 28. It's the Roman power, in summary, in Constantinople, out of one of them, as we saw there in chapter 8 and verse 9. Now, I've just put a box around that last statement. It's very important to establish as a territory that Constantinople is the seat of the power of this king. That's what that record is telling us, because that carries right through the rest of Daniel chapter 11. It's the eastern leg of Daniel chapter 2. You look at the points of comparison here in verse 36. He'll exalt himself, magnify himself above all the gods, and so forth. This is, in its fullness, the papal Catholic system. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. He opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or worship, sits in the temple of God as though he is God. Daniel 7 verse 8, a mouth speaking great things, associated again with the same power. So these words of verse 36 clearly have to do with the association of the papal power that began in that little territory. And his influence, as we said, will come right up to the time of Christ. Verse 37, he will not regard the God of his fathers. He will not regard the desire of women. He will not regard any God, and he'll magnify himself above all. And we know that's exactly what the Catholic system has done. They still today, to their shame, practice celibacy. And it's given them, we all know, the world knows, that has been at the basis of their issues in the times in which we live now. And that has been a hallmark of that system and their priesthood. He will not regard any God, and he shall magnify himself above all. We've seen that in 2 Thessalonians chapter 4. In verse 38, in his estate shall he honour the God of forces. Strange sort of words, aren't they? Brother Thomas has very good suggestions about that, which also concur with what other translators have. You see in your margin there, if you have the Oxford edition, against forces, it is the God's protectors. The idea of forces is one of protection, one of guardianship. It says munitions as well, which of course is a force for protecting yourself. But the basic idea is one of guardianship. And if ever there is a system that has one set up for saints, as they call them, it is that Catholic system. I've quoted you a section there from their own encyclopedia. Saints who are acknowledged to be special protectors, their own words, and intercessors for persons, churches, dioceses, and the universal church. You know this picture, the key of St. Peter, as they would say, and their basilica in Rome is built around that model of a key, as they hold the keys of the gospel, as they say from Peter. Look at all these statues, all the way around. If you've ever been there, they just surround you in the very pinnacle of their temple, let alone going into any of their churches. What did the record say? A God of protectors. Goes and repeats that in verse 39. It is a God of protectors, and it's a God whom their fathers knew not. They shall honour with gold, silver, precious stones, and pleasant things. Pagan gods of Rome were cast out and replaced by the Trinity and all the other trappings of Roman doctrine. The wealth of the papacy just goes without even question. Verse 39, he shall do this in the most strongholds with a strange God. Why is it a strange God? The Trinity is a strange God. It's based upon the traditions of Babylon and the traditions of Egypt. It has nothing to do with the scriptures of truth. A strange God to us, a strange God even to the pagan Romans. and their churches are full of images of guardian saints. He shall cause them to rule over many, shall divide the land for gain. It goes without saying, they have enormous sway, not so much politically any longer as they did up until the 1800s, but they still have enormous sway, and they have had for centuries and centuries. During the Crusaders, they particularly divided the land for gain, and they certainly still do that today with their shrines and their holy places. A very, very accurate list of identification with the papal little horn. Again, we won't go through those quotations, many of them we have touched already, but each one of them identifies without question that this little Roman power that developed around about the middle of the second century, the eastern leg of the Roman Empire, is the papal horn. And it will have and does have, that territory will have a great impact in the day to come, as Daniel is going to outline for us in the verses that follow. I want you to notice particularly that the point of this is that that papal phase of the little horn controlled and started in Pergamon, Istanbul, Constantinople, and they contained and controlled that place right up to 1453. That eastern leg of that Roman Empire, the western leg got shattered by the northern hordes, 400 or so AD, and eventually they got converted to Catholicism and the Catholic Church grew again from around 600 or so AD through the times of Charlemagne and onwards. That's over on the western side. This here is not concerned with that side. Revelation gives us that kind of detail. But here on the eastern side, the Roman Catholic and the Greek Orthodox, which are just an offshoot of each other, have controlled Constantinople right up until 1453. And then the Islamic peoples took over, swept through and finally conquered that place. They turned that cathedral into a mosque, and that today is a very sore point with the Turkish people, has been since Turkey was put into a civil administration by the Young Turks in 1922 or so, and we'll come to that in the next chapter. But when that happened, Turkey became a civil power, still Islamic, but they separated church and state. And it was a sore point. They turned that into a museum at that time, but now the Turkish people and their rulers are trying to turn it back into a mosque. 1453, we kicked these people out. But the point here is not so much just that history, but it's all happening there in the city of Constantinople. This is the king of verse 36. Not one particular power, but the power in control of that territory. I want you to just stop and reflect on that point. It's absolutely important if you follow this way of understanding these verses to make this connection, as Brother Thomas does. Verse 36 stops using King of the North, King of the South, and just says the king, because this was the Roman papal power in the first instance, starting up there in the second century BC. The power, it's not so much that it was Roman or whatever it was, but it was the seat of that power. Just like the King of the North, King of the South, didn't matter about their names or who they were, it was a territory they were controlling that is being described here. And it's the same thing in verse 36. It's the territory of that little horn, Constantinople. The hymn of verse 40, which is what we're coming to, I suppose, at the time of the South, the King of the South shall push at him. And the King of the North, come back to our terms again, South and North, shall come against him like a whirlwind. Now there are various interpretations of that verse, but the one that fits the context is that the him is the very king of verse 36, not the personage, but the territory that he controlled. That is Constantinople and the area of Turkey. So we come to verse 40 then. At the time of the end, Daniel longed for that time, but it wasn't to be for many days. What is this time of the end? Well, it's really a time which began in our days with the French Revolution. We're not going to go over to Revelation now and establish all of that, but there are three great earthquakes described there. One is Constantine, one is that French Revolution, and the third will happen when the Lord returns to the earth. They mark off terminal, seminal epochs in time. And the time of the end began with the overthrow of the French aristocracy. That began the time of the end. It says in verse 40, the king of the south shall push at him. Again, you can read Brother Thomas, and he has other suggestions because he was writing in the 1800s. And there was a push against Constantinople from some of the powers in the south. He wasn't wrong in that interpretation, but it wasn't the right timing, as we have now been able to see from history in our days. And we're going to link that with the things that happen in Daniel chapter 12 in our next class. The king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, and he shall enter into the countries. We've touched on this many times in lectures. The king of the north will be the power controlling that empire in the south there, the Seleucid Empire. And where is Russia today? Building up its ports in the land of Syria, the land of the Seleucid king of the north empire. And because it's taking that territory, it is not only associated with the uttermost parts of the earth of Ezekiel 38, it's identifying with the king of the north in this chapter here. And it's going to come against him. What? Constantinople. We don't know how or when that's exactly going to happen, but it's the same kind of thing again. God has said that power controlling the king of the north is going to come against that Turkish power in Constantinople, and territory at any rate. We saw the king of the south in the 1914 war. In 1918, Allenby and the British forces were there in the area of the king of the south. They were very much in control of Egypt, had done so because of the Suez Canal and other factors which over decades the angels doubtless were working towards, and it brought them into control in the First World War of the land of Egypt. And it was vital, if they were going to get rid of the Turks, that they'd be able to drive them out of the Middle East, exactly as God had intended. And so that's exactly what happened. We know all these images, I'm not going to go through them, but Allenby was the one, General Allenby here, coming into Jerusalem, taking a parade, and here he is down here in Egypt. These are maps of the times. The Australians had a role there with the Light Horse Brigade against Beersheba, and they swept up that coastal plain. They went right up that coastal plain, and by the end of the war had driven the Turks back into their territory in Turkey. The king of the south had pushed at him, the power in control of Constantinople. So we come then to verse 41 and the verses that follow, and we shall cover next week, and next fortnight. We have many of those things covered in lectures, so I will just sketch those verses for you and move particularly into chapter 12 on the next occasion. Daniel 11 is 2,600 years old, and yet God has swept down those years of history, particularly those 400 to 500 years before Christ, but he swept right forward and with precision shown us what has happened on the pages of history. He outlined it there, and we are privileged to see those times, to sit here waiting for that final move by Russia, sitting there ready to move from the territory of Syria, the territory of the king of the north, and to take up its role to take over Turkey, as we'll see later on, sweep down through those other territories that are there in Daniel 11 and elsewhere. The critics said, must have been written after its time. Well, you have to wait almost a day, wouldn't you, to write all of that stretch of history and not get it wrong. The eastern leg of the Daniel 2 image, precisely outlined by Gabriel to Daniel in Daniel chapter 11. Daniel's plea, of course, in chapter 12 is, how long? When are these times going to end? He said that 2,500 years ago. We are here at the very end of those times. The angel said, all right, Daniel, I'll give you some time periods when these things shall begin to come to an end. We're going to look at all of that detail in the last chapter of Daniel chapter 12. He's going to stand in his lot at the end of his days when that is all finally concluded. We are standing in those days. Let us make sure we are there with him at the time of the end when it's all consummated. Thank you.